Welcome to Leadership on the Go, a podcast brought to you by the Cranfield Alumni Team, where we speak to former Cranfield students to understand their experience of leadership in real-world situations.
Today, my guest is Daphne de Jong, and you need to know that she is a most remarkable lady. Daphne recently summited Everest, and that is just an amazing achievement in itself. But Daphne is amazing because she is also a pilot, flies aerobatics, has worked at NASA and at Amazon. Currently, she works as technical program manager at Waymo, formerly Google Self-Driving Car Project, and is a board member at UN Women. Best of all, she's one of us and a graduate of Cranfield, having completed a Master's in Aerospace Engineering in 2014. I really hope you enjoy listening to Daphne de Jong.
Let me just start by properly welcoming you to Leadership on the Go, which is a Cranfield podcast, as you know, and we selected to interview you because you're a Cranfield alumni. I'd like to start, if I may, with your connection to Cranfield, because I understand from your bio you did your first degree with us.
Yes, I'm very happy that I had time to spend at Cranfield. I think the leverage that it brought me in the rest of my career was huge, and I met people that I'm still very close in touch with. And that network, I call it network, but actually to me it's a friend group, has given me a lot. And we still check in on each other and help each other and make sure that we're doing well regarding our careers and also personally. So this is very important to me. I do work with a lot of people from different countries here at Google, and I think the things I learned at Cranfield, I still apply them here.
How is it to be a woman and a leader in the tech industry? What do you see as unique challenges?
Yeah, I think it's actually really great. Honestly, I think part of it is because I'm here at the right time. I was lucky enough to be at new tech companies, right? In my mind, there's old tech and new tech. I was very lucky to first start a little bit with old tech at NASA, where I learned about older systems, but also like learned about the knowledge of people from different generations and how they set their regulations in place, which is very important for such an experimental industry. Then I had a chance to take that to a new industry. I worked at Amazon on their drone delivery system. And basically, it was very different, right? You go from a very known aerospace institution to a company that is known for their software development, and then you try to develop airplanes there. I think the biggest trap that that is easily to fall into is to think that it's normal to come up with a product very quickly and then iterate in a fast cadence, learn, and then try to come up with the final product that way. The problem with that is that if it's a safety critical system, right, that there needs to be certain test cases in place, certain evaluation processes in place, that in such a new industry were non-existing. So having been part of a more like, I would say almost older industry, and then taking those skills to like a new tech company has really worked in my advantage, I think. The same applies to my current team, which is at Waymo. So that's Google driverless cars. We have similar challenges where it's a bigger company, right? Like Alphabet or in Google in this case is known for software development and not so much for creating a driverless car system. And being able to take that knowledge to this industry has been very, very helpful. So, and you also asked me about being a woman in those cases. I think it's been an advantage and a disadvantage. And the advantage is that I get to change the status quo in the sense that I can help defining who we need to hire, help defining why diversity is so important within such a new industry, which is really, really great. At the same time, I do notice that a lot of people higher up, they don't look like me, they don't talk like me. There's a lot of frustrations on a day-to-day basis that maybe people from the outside don't see.
Daphne, I noticed that because we started this conversation in a very casual manner, I haven't actually said congratulations on summiting Everest. So I need to sort of backtrack a bit and say, firstly, a huge congratulations on summiting Everest. And I wonder maybe if you can just help me understand one or two things that come out of the Everest experience, I will encourage our listeners to check out your TED talk and find the whole story of the Everest. But it seems to me that there's a couple of very big leadership lessons in that case study or in your personal experience of summiting Everest. What are your highlights in leadership terms?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. There's a lot of correlation actually between doing big expeditions and leadership. I think leadership can apply to your team, also to multiple teams, but also to yourself, right? Like self-management. And this is definitely a combination of all of those. First of all, such an expedition takes more than a couple of months. So you're in the middle of nowhere for a long period of time with people that you normally don't know very well. So this is when it becomes very important to understand that the mission is greater than yourself and that whenever you can jump in, that's when you need to do it and also let other people shine and shine on them, right? Make sure that they feel good about themselves. Like mentally, it's such a big challenge, physically as well, of course, but I'm mostly going to touch upon the mental part because that's very difficult to prepare for. All you can do is like climb other mountains, do other expeditions. But in the end, it's about how you maintain yourself under pressure. The overall leadership, I think it's about taking decisions, right? There is weather conditions, there is the number of people, there is the food that you still have left. Like there's all these factors that are part of this. And based on that, you need to take a decision when you go up, when you go down, when you need to stay safe. And those are key decisions that you have to make very quickly. So if someone in your team has information you don't have, that's very valuable, right? So taking a decision to go up, and in this case, wasn't to the summit, was a very important one. And there was lots of information to take into account. So I learned to really, really stay calm in many different situations and think about social interaction as something that's great and necessary, but also can be frustrating and that we just need to handle with care.
I wonder if you can just go back to the story you tell in your TED talk about, I think you're in the death zone as you describe it. I think you've got pink liquid coming from your mouth, I think is how you describe
it. Yeah.
I noted one small thing that you said, which is you said that in that moment, your self-talk changed. You stopped doubting yourself and you started coaching yourself. Those, I think, are almost your precise words. I wonder if you could expand on that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's entirely correct. So just after I reached the summit, I got acute mountain sickness. Turns out my oxygen mask wasn't working correctly. So I did not have oxygen at that moment. All my other systems failed. So my radio, my satellite phone, my medicine was mislabeled. So things that could go wrong went wrong at that point. And I was very sick. At some point, I thought, this is not going to be it. I can't do this. And actually, I really thought this was the end. Until other frustrations came into play. So for example, my satellite phone, I was on the top of the world and it said obstructed by objects, which was a big frustration to me. And I remember thinking, oh man, it's not supposed to go this way because at least I want to be able to say goodbye to my family if something happens. And then I remembered everything hurt so much. I thought, I don't want it to end this way. This is not how I imagined it to be. And then, even though throughout preparation for Everest, I've doubted myself and perhaps other people doubted myself, this is kind of the moment where I thought about other people I loved, about other people that really supported me throughout this journey. And then I decided that if I don't move now, then it will be the end. So I am the only one who can now save myself. So I decided that I'm going to have to do it. And it went through my mind that I prepared well. I did all these sessions. I did so many trainings. Why would I not be able to do it? And suddenly I got a burst of confidence that I really, really needed. And I somehow made it down.
I wonder also if when you translate that back to leadership in, let's say, the office environment, not that you're in a normal office environment, but you are nevertheless no longer up a mountain, If you're back in the office and you are working as a leader, is there a danger that you now have so much self-confidence, you have so much belief in what you're able to achieve, that you're unable to see other people's doubts about themselves, that somehow you've become larger than life and it's difficult for you to remember what it's like to be immortal?
No, not at all. I actually think that it's a bit the opposite in a way where when I drive to work, I sometimes have to think and look in the mirror and think, okay, I can do this, right? And I really need to give myself some confidence. So it's not so much that I'm continuously disconfident now, but when I need it, I know I can fall back into that mode, which is really important and it's helped me in many different situations. There are certain things that are now built into my muscle memory, situations that were very difficult and I got myself out of it. And that is something I can think about when things become very, very difficult. So at work, working with different teams, I think it's very important to actually also look at the human aspect and not just what is their output, what is the quality of work they deliver, but also why. Perhaps they had a bad week. Perhaps something else is going on. I think this plays is a very important aspect of my day-to-day life, because I think if you care about the people around you, inherently you'll have a better team. And this is funny. It's something that I said to another woman that I met on Everest. We were both surrounded by guys and much older men. And at some point we went down and we looked at each other. We said, wow, why is everybody making this a competition? Why are they continuously talking about what we're going to do the next day as if we're competing against ourselves and everyone else day after day after day? It puts so much pressure on ourselves and we can't sleep. It's so much stress. It's not even fun anymore. And then we said, okay, let's decide that this will be good, that we're going to look around, enjoy the nature together, and then realize what an opportunity it is to be in this kind of an environment, in this stage of our life. And that completely changed how I felt every single day. So at work, by showing care, I think people will care about you as well as about the output of the project and what's best for the company.
I'm really fascinated with that twist that you've just described, where you're going to put your head up, you're going to stop climbing just for a nanosecond, just for a heartbeat, so that you can actually relish what you're doing.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you're right, it's all in the details, which also means that we need to listen more to the bottoms up, right, approach. So we need to listen to the engineers, we need to listen to people who might not have the same level, because they will actually be in the weeds and they will understand what's actually going on. And we can talk about it at higher levels, but as you know, people get busy, they go to lots of meetings, they actually won't have time to really be in the weeds continuously. So I think it's actually very, very important to have this continuous communication channel between all levels of a team.
You're bringing up really interesting topics, which I think are hugely relevant to our listeners, which is, I think one of the things many leaders struggle with is having enough contact with, as you described them, the engineers who are in the weeds. So they have enough grasp of detail, but they don't get sucked down to micromanage, and they don't work at such a stratospheric level that they've lost touch with the real people who are doing the real work. Can you describe how you cope with that tension? What do you do? How do you manage it? What do you
do? This is actually the main part of my job, I would say, because I find it very, very important. So mostly it's about listening and making the people who work on the product, so the actual engineers, feel like they make an impact. And as I mentioned before, it's all about creating the picture, right? Understanding like what our goals are and then showing them what their individual contribution was to that final goal. And then hopefully show some improvement. So You can do that in many different ways. I like to have meetings with every individual now and then, not too often because indeed you don't want to micromanage. But you create this trust relationship where you can, you know, you can rely on each other, and it's beyond metrics and beyond reporting. And it's more about, okay, I know this is a good person. They know they have a goal to meet. They know I expect them to reach out to me when something escalates. Having all of that on the same page means that you don't need to push for things all the time. Because at some point, you know that this person will reach out to you when it goes wrong, and vice versa. At the same time, you do want to stay up to date because I think it's very important, especially when you take decisions, that you know what's actually going on. So by making the people who do the work feel like they contribute, you say, okay, well, give me a spiel of like 30 minutes and tell me what you've worked on lately so that I understand it better, which also makes them feel valued, important, which is what they are. But it's really important to continuously keep that momentum going, I think.
An idea has just struck me that we've been kind of pointing to in all this conversation, which is about being comfortable with being uncomfortable or being comfortable with a little bit of doubt in your mind. So I think you use doubt very creatively on the trek up Everest, and it sounds to me like you're using doubt very creatively in some of your leadership and in some of the ways that you develop people. How does that chime with you when I say that?
I agree. And I think it's all about being honest to yourself. And that's a lesson that took me a long time to learn, because very often, especially when you're one of the only in a class, in a room, in at work, I think usually you think that maybe you're not good enough, or why am I here, or do I fit in, etc. And there's a lot of self-doubt. I think the several ways to get out of that, but also to say, okay, over time, I know I became good at this one thing and at that thing and maybe at that thing as well. And then when something doesn't go very well, I don't just doubt myself, but I also think maybe I'm not working on the right thing for me, which is a very different way of thinking about kind of the same problem. But instead, you don't make it about something that you do wrong. It's a more positive approach, I would say. And something you can actually work with, because if it's you, then you might as well give up, right? but you have to always find a solution for things, I think, and sometimes thinking about things differently helps with that.
Thank you, Daphne. I'm aware of time, so I know that you wanted to talk about your future expedition. I think this is to document climate change.
Yeah.
What would you... What's important for our listeners to know about this, and how can they follow you and help you? And let's leverage this podcast.
Yeah, thank you. I think I would love to talk about it. This time we decided we're going to go with an all-female team. We're going to Greenland. We're crossing the island from south to north while kite skiing. We want to be self-reliant, and while we do that, we create content for education in the United States and other places on climate change. We're also working with several companies on this. Yeah, I think because now, especially climate change is such a current topic, we want to create a level of awareness that we don't think is there yet. More details, more like direct impact. So if this happens, how does it affect your home? Especially focused on younger people, including children. Yeah, I mean, Greenland currently is one of these places where it has an ice sheet that's almost 2 miles deep in the middle. And theoretically, if it went to melt, then the sea level would rise 7.5 meters worldwide. This is catastrophic, right? Right now, 300 tons of ice melts every single year and doesn't refreeze. So this is already ongoing, and it's going faster and faster. There's a lot of research in the bubbles of air in the ice that we can understand better what caused these changes and what we can do about it. And this is something I'm very passionate about. And again, it's about going to beautiful places that are also very affected by climate change and also just by human impact. And going there as an all-female team will also change our team dynamics and the message we want to convey.
So I'm going to have to ask you how the leadership is being thought about for this expedition and whether you have a nominated leader, whether you are working on a shared or distributed leadership model. What is it you're doing to organize yourself? Because it must be a group of peers, right? It's all women who are volunteering, all putting themselves out there to do this thing. It's a big thing. No one single person has the right to say, I am the leader, which is just great. But how are you making decisions? How are you creating that leadership, that direction and alignment?
This is exactly it, right? I mean, this is the main challenge. So leadership is done in many different ways. So first of all, it's not one team. There's a PR team, there's an education team, there's a science team. Like, there's people who might not join on this journey who are still involved in their own way. Then there's different skill sets, right? Like, one of the women, she's a professional polar explorer. She also makes documentaries. The other one is a professional mountain guide. She's also a writer for many different magazines. We all have our own skill sets. And we said, okay, so let's define our best areas and say, if anything in these areas goes wrong, then that specific person will take charge. And for example, if that's anything related to avalanches, then my friend who is a professional mountain guide will say, okay, I will take charge, right? And that is really dependent on the areas. If it's anything related to sports gear, like the gear itself, I will be the one jumping in. As long as we have very clear roles and responsibilities.
So you've just provided a very small piece of evidence, but maybe a critical piece of evidence for something that's emerging in the academic literature. And I'll just put my researcher hat on for 2 minutes and share this with you. There's something called fluid power, which is a new idea that within teams, where there is a high level of psychological safety, it is possible to work in the manner that you've just described, whereby people know who needs to lead at any particular juncture, you know, that everybody falls in behind the person who has the most relevant expertise. And when it's not immediately obvious who that person should be, that can be negotiated in the moment. It's quite possible for people to sit down and have those conversations about who feels able to help us think our way out of this hole, you know.
Exactly.
And it's just such a lovely new piece of research that's just coming out in leadership, which is we don't have to have a person. We can have many people who are sharing responsibility and allowing the power to be completely fluid.
Yeah, and I think that's indeed the ideal situation. It also requires you to know each other really, really well, because it's very easy to make assumptions about people that you don't know very well, and then it might go wrong. So I think this kind of leadership is super interesting, but it will probably take a lot of effort and time that you spend in your team members. And also, as long as there's clear responsibilities when something does go wrong. I think as long as all those things are stated in advance, then yes, that should work. I can see it work very well in corporate teams, or right, to make everyone also feel valued and be really part of the decision taking.
And I guess my last question is a wrap-up question I try and ask everybody I've interviewed for this podcast. What's your advice to future leaders?
Yeah, to maybe start a project or a company, something small, it doesn't take too much time on the side, because you'll get to know yourself really well. And right now, I understand my limitations so much better than 10 years ago, 5 years ago, because I've gone through certain challenges myself where I push myself too far, not far enough, etc. And I know my limitations really well. And I think it's easier to experiment on your own than with your own team at work. And kind of bring your personal story into your work. So share that with your team, like invite them over at your house. I think that level of personal interaction will eventually create a safer space for people to speak up in. And I think this is really important for people to feel some sort of togetherness and become a more, like a stronger team.
Thank you. That is a lovely way to finish and reminds me of a hashtag that Phil Renshaw and I have in our social media posts. Phil Renshaw and I have written a book together, but our hashtag is leaders don't lead alone.
Exactly. I love that hashtag. I 100% agree with that and I probably got to use that.
Well, still with pride, Daphne, I'm going to boast quite heavily about having met you in person. Okay, well, Cranfield says thank you for joining us and every alumni at Cranfield is cheering from the sideline for you.
Thank you. It gives me goosebumps. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening today. And if you'd like to learn more about Phil Renshaw and me, please be sure to visit our website, www.coachingonthego.co.uk, or jump on Amazon and search for Coaching on the Go, where you'll find our latest book.
Thank you for listening along with us. If you'd like to hear more episodes like this, you can find Leadership on the Go on cranfield.ac.uk/alumni, where you can browse our complete archive and check out new episodes.